Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, you're with Rear Vision on Radio National Summer, and I'm Annabelle Quince. In today's program, the story of Afghanistan and the new great game.
5 years ago, the Bush administration hailed the collapse of the Taliban in Afghanistan as the first victory in the war on terror. But the Taliban is making a comeback, and now there are fears about the long-term future of the Afghan government.
Gunmen on motorbikes have shot dead the head of the Women's Affairs Department, while US troops have killed at least 10 Taliban fighters today.
In 2001, Britain and the US launched airstrikes against Afghanistan, and the Taliban government collapsed like a house of cards. Within months, foreign peacekeepers arrived, and by 2005, the first parliamentary elections in 30 years were held. But 6 years on, the Taliban is still a force. Despite the fact that many coalition lives have been lost, including three Australians in the last 3 months. So is the battle for Afghanistan one that we can win? Situated at the crossroads of Central Asia, Afghanistan's 22 million people are a complex mosaic of Islamic ethnic groups. Michael Barry from the Department of Islamic Art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York argues that it was during the 18th century and the time of the imperial struggle between Britain and Russia that modern Afghani identity and nationhood was forged.
Afghanistan really emerges under such a name in the 18th century when so many countries, so many kingdoms grew up on the ruins of what had been the great Mughal Indian Empire. Most of those kingdoms only endured for a generation or two before they were taken over by the British. The miracle of Afghanistan is that Afghanistan, because of the peculiar place it was in, right on the frontier of the Indian world, was able to preserve its independence as a combination of a ferocious will to resist the British on the part of the Afghans themselves, and also because ultimately it suited the British Empire to preserve an independent Afghan state as a buffer, insulating the British Indian Empire from the expanding Russian Empire.
This clash of empires in the 18th century is known as the Great Game. Karl Meyer is author of Torment of Shadows, The Great Game and the Race for Empire in Asia.
You had in Russia in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century a steady southward and eastward push into Asia and the Caucasus. And on the other side of Afghanistan, you had the British, who under the British East India Company were pushing northward. And as the British pushed northward and the Russians pushed southward, Afghanistan was the landlocked country in the middle. And what the Great Game was about, in good part, was the British apprehension and fear that the Russians would conquer Afghanistan, used it as a springboard for an attack on India or to incite a rebellion among the Muslims, the Muslim minority under the Raj. And twice in the 19th century, they had what we would call preemptive wars, i.e., that on the basis of intelligence suggesting that the Russians were there and were up to some nefarious schemes, twice the British in the 1840s and then again in the 1870s had massive invasions of Afghanistan.
It was during the first invasion of Afghanistan that one of the worst military disasters in British imperial history occurred.
They had a garrison in Kabul, and in 1841, the garrison was overwhelmed and had to retreat to the borders of India. In the course of that retreat, the Afghans decimated the entire army. The British lookouts on the Indian side in Jalalabad, actually, looking for news of the army, saw a single rider coming on horseback. And they said, oh, look, here comes the messenger. He'll tell us what's happened. The messenger was a surgeon named Bryden, and he was the sole survivor of a garrison of some 15,000 people. So this burnt heavily into the British consciousness.
The British had not been used to fighting in terrain like Afghanistan and had many lessons to learn.
Originally, the British armies came in blazing red uniforms, and that made them very easy marks for Afghan snipers who were superb rifle shots. So the British learned from that, and they developed a new kind of uniform using the word khaki. And the word khaki is the Persian word for dust. So the British learned militarily that it was much wiser to have your army come in drab-colored uniforms, not in blazing red. In the second Afghan war, you had a shrewder general, General Roberts. And General Roberts learned to fight the Afghan way and did better. So instead of being a humiliating defeat, you could say that the war ended in a deadlock in the 1870s. And a pragmatic, rough-and-ready peace was made with the emir named Rahman.
This rough-and-ready peace included the Afghans retaining their independence if they agreed to keep the Russians at bay.
The British were anxious to keep the Russians out. The Afghans agreed to keep the Russians out. In return, the British provided a subsidy for the Afghans. They provided other, particularly weapons. They provided a material assistance to the Afghans. And so that in both wars, having started out by trying to impose their will, the British learned that they had to engage with the people that represented the dominant political power in the country.
Political power in Afghanistan was and is based on tribal loyalties. And the largest tribal group are the Pashtuns, who have always supplied the emirs or rulers of Afghanistan. In 1893, the British insisted that the emir agree to the establishment of a border between Afghanistan and British India. The border, known as the Durand Line, was to clarify their respective areas of responsibility. The only problem was the British didn't consult the Pashtun tribes whose area was to be divided by this new frontier.
There is no doubt that the Durand Line is of an historical importance that I think one can compare to the Berlin Wall. It became one of the great fault lines of the Cold War, and it's interesting to see that it was carved out by the British, and namely by Sir Mortimer Durand, a British Indian official, in order to ensure that British troops with horse-drawn artillery could reach Kabul within 48 hours to forestall a possible Russian move to capture Kabul, putting the Afghan capital in a very vulnerable position, the heart of the kingdom within striking distance of the British imperial power. And when the British withdrew and gave that territory to Pakistan, we were able to see in the 1980s, during the struggle against the Soviet Union, that the bulk of materiel and resistance movements went back and forth just along that salient drawn by Sir Mortimer Durand. And it is in that salient that ultimately bin Laden and his lieutenant, Ayman al-Zawahiri, found refuge at the end of 2001. Be that as it may, whatever the strategic advantage to Britain of drawing this line, the emir who accepted it, Emir Abdurrahman again, accepted but told the British, you are forcing me to give up this territory to you, and I have to stand with you because I fear the Russians even more. And yet, his warning to the British was, I have trouble controlling the tribes along that frontier, and I am of their nation, I am of their language, I am of their faith, and I cannot control them. Do you think you will be able to control them?
When the Pashtun tribes on the British side of the line realized that they were to be the subject of Queen Victoria rather than the Emir of Kabul, they rose up in rebellion in 1897. The rebellion only ended when the British gave the tribes almost complete autonomy.
The British told the tribes, look, we will raise no taxes. British Indian law will not apply in your territories. You can run your village life and your tribal affairs exactly as you see fit. You can buy and sell on your markets anything you want. You can have your feuds. You can have Quranic law. You can have tribal law. We don't care. All we ask for is for three roads to lead from administrated British Indian territory to the Afghan border through your territory, but British law will only apply along those roads from sunup to sundown, and at night we relinquish control. And so the British were able to mollify the tribes this way, and as a result, they created along the Afghan border the largest tribal autonomous zone extant anywhere on the surface of the earth.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and via MP3 player with me, Annabelle Quince. In today's program, we're taking a look at the history of Afghanistan. In 1919, a new emir of Afghanistan tried to renegotiate the peace and reclaim the tribal lands on the British side of the Durand Line. When the British refused to negotiate, the Afghan army crossed the Durand Line and the British invaded Afghanistan.
During the First World War, there was a brief, some would call it the Third Afghan War, and that was quite interesting because what proved decisive for the British in assuring that Afghanistan would not side with the Germans and would heed the interests of the Raj was air power. And you had the use of bombing planes, which terrified initially the tribal peoples and which were used against the capital, Kabul.
While initially successful, the invasion was short-lived. War-weary Britain had no desire to wage an ongoing war in Afghanistan. A peace was agreed and the Durand Line was re-established. Then, in 1947, everything changed when Britain withdrew from India.
At that time, India, one-fifth of humanity, was still a British imperial possession.
Muslims of India have shown to the world that they are a united nation.
By 1940, Jinnah came up with a political concept that would alter the course of Indian politics. That concept was Pakistan.
In 1947, when the British withdrew, they left these territories to Pakistan. And this is where these territories and the Durand Line become one of the fault lines of the emerging Cold War, because Afghanistan in 1947 demanded the restitution of these territories. The Pakistanis refused to relinquish these territories to Afghanistan. And therefore, in 1947, as no one remembers today except the Pakistanis, Afghanistan became the only country in the world to vote against Pakistan's accession to the United Nations. And Afghanistan's stand against Pakistan, Afghanistan's territorial demands on Pakistan, and Afghanistan's refusal to recognize the Durand Line were immediately supported by the two countries that Pakistan identified as its mortal enemies. One was India, and the other was the Soviet Union.
After the Second World War, Afghanistan was regarded as strategic real estate, and there was a keen interest on both the Russian and the American and British side to ingratiate themselves with the rulers in Afghanistan. I remember talking with a British diplomat who was posted there during that era, and he said, well, that the Russians were good on providing economic aid, and one of the first things they did is to pave a highway from Kabul to the borders of the Soviet Union. And my diplomat friend said, and we knew in our heart of hearts that someday that highway would be used by Soviet tanks charging towards Kabul, which is indeed what happened.
In April 1978, a communist government led by Nur Mohammad Taraki seized power in Kabul. Its efforts to modernize and radicalize the country were too abrupt and too brutal for many of the strongly traditionalist and fundamentally religious Muslims of the countryside to accept, and they took up arms against the new government. Taraki was deposed and executed in September 1979 by a rival communist faction leader, Hafizullah Amin, but he was no more able to control events than his predecessor. Kabul came under siege by insurgents, Soviet advisers began taking heavy casualties, and the Kremlin moved.
President Carter has again condemned the Soviet Union over its involvement in Afghanistan.
Next month will mark the second anniversary of the intervention of Soviet forces in Afghanistan to assist the country's...
In two British-Afghan wars, and also in the case of the Soviet invasion in 1979, the military were distinctly unenthusiastic about embarking on it. The decisions were made by political superiors. In the case of the Soviet invasion, it was Brezhnev. Brezhnev and Gromyko overruled the objections of their senior military staff about the difficulties of occupying this country.
When the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, they stirred up a hornet's nest. They broke the cardinal rule of Afghan politics, which the British had finally learned, which is you can exert influence in the country through its government if you subsidize its government. But one thing the Afghans will never stand for is the presence of foreign troops on Afghan soil. Now, the Soviets also went out of their way in the very first years to break what they perceived as the Islamic identity of Afghanistan and launched a persecution of the Islamic religion so severe as necessarily to provoke such an almost suicidal resistance on the part of the Afghans. Until 1985, in a sense, the Soviets were winning through genocide. They weren't politically winning, but they were winning the way, I suppose, you could say that the United States won against the Apaches, simply through overwhelming, crushing force, through genocidal policies. But when the United States was finally persuaded to deliver, along with the British, anti-aircraft weaponry like the Stingers and the blowpipes to members of the Afghan resistance, the Soviets, as of 1986, lost control of the air, and as soon as they lost control of the air, they lost all control of the ground, and their expeditionary force was doomed.
Hassan Kaka was professor of history at Kabul University and spent 5 years in prison because of his opposition to the Soviet invasion. He argues that Pakistan's support for extremist Islamic groups undermined moderate opposition groups in Afghanistan.
At that time, the overriding concern of Afghans, including me, was how to be able to expel the Russian army from Afghanistan. But it was the government of Pakistan. Because of the Durand Line, there must be a regime in Afghanistan, which tomorrow when the Russians withdraw, they will have a very subordinate position to Pakistan. And hence, they helped those Islamic organizations who were extremes and who at the same time wanted to accept the influence of Pakistan and the nationalist elements, the democratic elements, the patriotic elements, or those other groups were almost discarded.
It was Pakistan's choice, of course, to see to it that the most deadly weaponry was directed into the hands of those Islamist groups who were expected to take power in Kabul following the Soviet withdrawal in a manner that would bring Afghanistan under complete Pakistani influence.
The United States allowed itself to become the armorer and the patron of the most extreme Islamic groups in the Mujahideen. That means the Army of the Faithful, who were the resistance against the Soviet Union. There was a moderate secular wing of the resistance. They got passed over, and partly because the Pakistanis, for their own reasons, wanted to have a fundamentalist and Islamic government beholden to them in Kabul, we let the Pakistanis determine who got the weapons we supplied. And that was, I think, a tragic mistake, out of which came, among other things, Osama bin Laden.
A general has crossed the Afghan border towards home in the final act of the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan.
According to the latest edition of the Weekly Literary Gazette, almost 15,000 Soviet soldiers and officers died, and nearly 37,000 were crippled.
It was barren, rocky hills like these which defeated first the British and now the Soviets. Tony Melville at the Khyber Pass.
as the Soviets were withdrawing, you had murder squads in the Afghan refugee camps in Pakistan busily exterminating, there's no other word for it, all those educated Afghans who seemed to promise the possibility of some kind of moderate civilized government in Kabul to replace the Soviets as they withdrew. Instead, the most right-wing elements of the Pakistani army, who were pretty much in charge of Afghan operations, were intent that the country should be practically lobotomized in order to open power to the people who would bring Afghanistan under a Pakistani protectorate as Islamists. Another element of the tragedy is that in the 1980s and well into the 1990s, the United States found itself ranged on one side of what can be described as a great Islamic civil war. When the United States decides that it is its vital interest to support such Sunni powers as Saudi Arabia and Pakistan against Iran, the Shi'i power, and the United States was so intent on making sure that a post-Soviet Afghanistan should not slip under Iranian influence, that it bankrolled and fully supported the Saudi-Pakistani determination to install a Sunni-Pakistani protectorate in Afghanistan. Hence the paradoxical U.S. support for the Taliban.
In Afghanistan, Taliban forces have taken control of the capital, Kabul.
2 weeks ago, the Taliban moved into Afghanistan's second-largest city of Jalalabad. The takeover came as a surprise, not because the Taliban managed to do it, but because it came with a minimum of bloodshed.
There is a Chinese proverb saying that the wall has two sides. The Taliban, they had brought stability and peace to the areas under their control. But they, as a people, were utterly unable to rule even a village, let alone the country. At the last year of the Taliban, I went from America to Afghanistan. People were really, really oppressed. And they really had lost spirit. I even, could not see a man who would really laugh loudly.
This morning, the people of Kabul awake to their first full day of life free of the extreme Islamic strictures of the Taliban.
The forces of Taliban and Al-Qaeda have several choices. They can flee and reorganize in the south. They can flee and melt into the countryside. If they reorganize in the south, we're going to go get them. And if they decide to flee, I doubt that they'll find peace wherever they select.
For a rather brief moment, but brief moment of some 2 or 3 years, the Western troops, U.S., British, Canadian, and other, were actually rather welcomed in Afghanistan because memory was so recent of the Taliban as Pakistani surrogates that a plurality of Afghans welcomed the Westerners. But the Western troops are wearing out their welcome because the West did so little as to amount to almost nothing in terms of improving the Afghan standard of living, even in the capital city itself. As living standards in Afghanistan continue to plummet, Afghans are turning against the West for having betrayed them in the most fundamental sense. And where I think we're coming to a final tragedy is that the Taliban are making a nationalist comeback now, especially since those who are pro-Taliban on the Pakistani side or increasingly on the Afghan side see that the United States is weakening. And when the Taliban come back into the villages of southern Afghanistan, they are telling the people, the Americans are leaving, they're never going to come back. When we come back, we come back to stay. You better make your peace with us. Terrifying message, but an effective one.
That's the program. Thanks to this week's sound engineer, John Jacobs, and ABC Archives. I'm Annabelle Quince.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.